Today's lecture, or today's broadcast, is going to be about the subject of competition. I think it's a very interesting subject. I think it's an interesting subject because what it does, competition to us, is it transforms us in a very radical way. Sometimes that transformation is good, and sometimes that transformation is not so good. In other words, this kind of form of competition, it gives us a benefit sometimes, it helps us sometimes, and sometimes it puts a burden upon us, it puts stress upon us, it creates a situation whereby we end up in a much, shall we say, more difficult place than we ever were before. So I'm going to give examples of both, and I'm going to speak about a principle which I think is very important for us to understand. And the reason I'm talking about this, which is a very practical thing, it's a very practical discussion. And last week was also a very practical discussion. Is that even though we are mainly concerned with spiritualism, spirituality, issues which are connected to and predominantly concerned with spirituality. Sorry, here, just fixing me. We find that the practical issues cause us to be deviated from our spiritual ideals. In other words, even though we are spiritualists, even though we may even be mystics, practical interactions with this world, specifically with other people, can deviate ourselves or deviate us from focusing on, concentrating on, and being effective at what we do spiritually. What to speak of how it deviates us from our material desires, material goals. Now, competition is also a good thing. Spiritual competition, I don't think so. I'm not even sure such a thing exists. Of course, we can adjust it in our minds and create some philosophical thing which explains how a spiritual competition is also a good thing. But I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't even want to talk about it. I don't think it's relevant. It's like some theoretical idea. But practically speaking, competition in the real sense of the term here in this world can be a good thing. Like, for example, if you're doing business and you are the only one doing business. Like, let's take, for example, Microsoft and Windows. You're all using computers, otherwise you couldn't see this broadcast. Before Apple became an extremely powerful force in the technology department, Microsoft could get away with creating products which were filled with bugs, which created so many difficulties and problems for people whenever the updates took place. They didn't care about security. Basically, they just did what they wanted, and they knew you, the end user, had really not much choice because they were the only operating system on the block. Then along, Apple comes with its 10 series operating systems, and people start gradually catching on to the fact that it's easier, it generally works better, although the myth that it always works is a joke, but besides that. But that it's superior. So then Microsoft, because of seeing this competition, starts looking at it. And they realize they have to keep up with it because it's starting to grow. So they start taking elements of the Mac operating system and incorporating them. They start worrying about security. They start worrying about compatibility. They start worrying about ease of use and the experience, the pleasant experience for the user. So from that point of view, Microsoft has benefited enormously from the competition with Apple. I mean, while I'm broadcasting here, I have a little window in the corner of my screen with Windows 7 running. And even though I've been using Apple for, I don't know, centuries, I like Windows 7. It kind of works. Updating's not a problem. Updating has never destroyed anything. And it feels more secure. Anyway, it's got its problems too, but okay, it's Windows, but it's a lot better. So I'm very thankful to Apple for being a big kid on the block so that there's now a competition. Now, in that sense, if you're the only one who can do something, the only impetus for you to grow and improve has to come from yourself. And since most people are inherently lazy, meaning unless there's a reason for them to develop, they don't do it, not having any competition is not favorable. Having competition is a very favorable thing. It forces us to examine what we're doing to make it more efficient, better, safer, faster, more accommodating, so that we can actually improve to attract facilities or attract people and so on. These are business principles, social principles. These principles are even principles for individuals. When we are in competition with others, it can help us. It can encourage us. That's the positive side of it. The negative side of it is that it creates unnecessary conflict. I'll give you an example which I found to be very relevant, something which I studied very carefully, something which I examined very carefully during my practically entire time managing things, and even up to the very present moment, is individual and group dynamics. Now, this is also a very fundamental spiritual principle, because an individual's dynamics with another individual begins with and is energized by how I think about myself, how I feel about myself, how I am therefore able to accept another person, empathize with another person, and therefore appropriately respond to another person. Let's say I have low self-esteem. Now, it is not that low self-esteem is a phenomena that's only there for a couple of people. Low self-esteem is a phenomena that is practically universal. Again, if we think about that theory I have, that the reason we are here in this world is because we are feeling ourselves to be not good enough, and that our whole purpose and our whole work here is to prove to ourselves that we are good enough, then low self-esteem is a universal principle, because feeling not good enough is low self-esteem. And therefore, what we are doing when we have interactions with others is that to a large extent, we are trying to prove that we are good enough. We are defending our status. Now, that doesn't happen all the time. For example, if I go to the store to buy something and I talk to the salesperson or whatever, generally I'm not having that conflict. If I'm saying hi to somebody somewhere, generally I'm not having that conflict. But there are occasions, and we are all aware of them, of when this kind of feeling of defending our low self-esteem is very apparent. If you look in spirituality, in all spiritual societies, you will find conflict in competition as some feel they must prove themselves or they must defend themselves or establish themselves as good, better, superior. Because if I'm better than you, if I'm superior to you, if I am in an elite group, a special group of persons, then I am not lacking. I am good enough. I am so good that I have entrance into this elite group, this special group. And even though I may not have had to prove myself to get into this group, like, for example, I could have been there as one of the founding members, and therefore that the founding members didn't have to prove anything. There was nobody to prove anything to. Or I might have been invited in just because of friendship, or I might have just fallen into it. But often this elite group, the members of it individually, create a set of qualifications that others may have, new people must have, to enter into the elite group. Because this solidifies their status as the elite. After all, if anyone can join the elite, it's not elite, it's anyone, everyone. So you create a group, you create standards and qualifications, and you restrict entry. And you even encourage competition for people to prove themselves, prove themselves to be qualified to enter the elite group. This is something which we find even amongst communities, families, people, where you're not qualified to be my friend. Now, sure, I know in my own life, there are people who are my friends. I can be friendly with enormous amounts of people. There's my family, who I'll always be friendly with because they're my family. It's an elite group of biological connections. But the friends that are there because they really are friends. Friendship is not something that you can put a standard on. It's just your friends. You can hang out together, you can sit around together, you can do nothing together and feel quite happy about it, just as long as you have the company of the other person. That's my definition of friendship, when there's that energetic connection, that energetic sharing between people, which just simply says, we're friends. That is, okay, a group that we discriminate about, because energetically speaking, there are those who energetically work, and there are those who energetically don't work. It's not even that we make some conscious delineation. You're my friend because. You're not my friend because. When we're talking about long-term sustainable friendship, you're my friend simply because you are. You're not really the same kind of friend simply because you're not. It's just the way it is. It's not even something that we can control. It's something which just is there. It's something which is just. It's just what it is. It's just what it is because that's what it is. It's not like you can even have it as something else. It's just simply what it is. It is something which is the nature of what we are as individuals. Okay, so when we are dealing with this situation, we should be aware of it. We should be aware of what we're doing. We should say, yes, you're my friend not because of something. You're just my friend. And you're not my friend because of something. It's just the way it is. But I shall be friendly with everyone because why not? What have I got to lose? So that's a very important point, because this honesty about it will remove various illusory expectations and will keep things very clear, at least in our own minds. You don't really have to prove anything to a friend because a friend accepts you as you are. You don't have to prove anything. They accept that you are what you are. There's no need to prove what you are. They know what you are. Friends know each other. They don't have to hide or act. Friends see through that. That's one of the definitions of friends. They don't require the act to prove worth of friendship. Friends don't have to prove their worth. And even when you do it, nobody takes it seriously. Isn't that interesting? Even Arjuna admitted to Krishna during this, when Krishna showed him the universal form, Arjuna said, oh, please forgive me for the way I have spoken with you or deprecated your worth during times of self-aggrandizement, when we advertised ourselves as being so great to each other, or when I just laughed at you in a various way about when you said how great you were to me. Because that's friendship, we don't take it seriously. We just like to be together. Let's move on to another point which is related to this, but which is actually, I think, very important in this practical discussion here. It's about meetings. Meetings. Even you say this word, sometimes people become very disturbed just by hearing the word meetings. Oh my God, a meeting. Let's talk about meetings for a second. Now, when we get together and meet, there are dynamics involved. These dynamics can be very troublesome. They can be very disturbing. Let's start about the format of a meeting. The physical format. Those who are expert at meetings know all this stuff very well. You will see when they walk into the room, they immediately examine the geometry of the room. What kind of table is it? How are the chairs arranged? Now, the optimal meeting geometry, optimal meeting format, is a circle. If you look, for example, at the United Nations Security Council or any organization which has as its definition the fact of equal representation, you will have a circular format. If you look at Alcoholics Anonymous groups or Narcotics Anonymous groups or therapeutic groups where people are expected to share in a certain format, it'll be a circular format. If you look at the square format, let's say everybody is facing somebody. Sometimes in these meetings, somebody gets up and stands up in front of the group, because that's also therapeutic. They stand up in front of the group and they speak to the group. They're making a presentation. They are saying, I feel secure enough in myself and safe enough with you that I can tell you how I feel about these things. And the audience listens. This is the format of presentation. There is somebody who presents to you. Now, if a meeting were to be like that, it's very troublesome, because you've got those who are in the authority. They're standing on a stage. They're higher. They're the focus of all attention. And the people in the audience are lesser, lower, may only speak when called upon, and are one of many voices, all of them being less significant than the person on the stage. Not a format conducive to good meetings. It's a presentation format. Then you have meetings where there's either a rectangle or there's some kind of point which points to a chairman. A chairman who runs meetings. A chairman who makes things happen, who calls on people who are going to speak, who determines how long you can speak, who has an agenda and makes it flow. So all of the people in the meeting are facing the chairman, either by moving their seats towards the chairman, or the geometry of the room focuses on the chairman. They're not really addressing each other. It's not really an equal situation. Even if they are all equals, the very geometry of the room creates a dichotomy between the person at the head and everyone else. And by geometric creation, everyone has to fight for a position, has to somehow attract others by being somewhat special. Otherwise, you have the situation where the chairman says, you say something, so I say something. Everybody kind of sits there, couldn't care less. Somebody else couldn't care less. That will change. I'll speak about that. But the geometry is this. And then you vote. A circular meeting, on the other hand, may have a facilitator of the meeting, but the facilitator is not the center. The facilitator is one of the group. Nobody is the center. Nobody is the focus. Everybody is equally important geometrically. No one has to fight to have people's physical presence towards them. Everyone is automatically in the best possible place to make a presentation. Therefore, geometrically, the circle is a perfect format for having a meeting. That's a very important point. Meetings should be in a circular format. But what if the meeting is forced into a rectangular format? Because most people are not very aware of these principles. What would an intelligent meeting person do Where would an experienced meeting person sit? Well, the chairman is the focus. If you sit next to the chairman or on that line of the chairman, if the chairman is on the short side especially, but this also works if the chairman is on the long side, your position is nullified. You have no impact whatsoever. You are a geometric clone of the chairman. Your power to influence is very little. So people who do not want to be nullified, people who want to influence, never sit there. People who want to hide, who want to appear to be important, appear to be influential, choose those seats because it's an appearance of power, but they will just sit there and say nothing. If people want to also disappear from a meeting, they sit in the very rear parts of that corner along the line of the long sides in a rectangular room. Because everybody looks forward, they're in the side and the back. So they can choose to not be there, to doodle, to pay no attention. No one sees what they're doing except the chairman, but the chairman doesn't bother because they're in a place where you can't really see them so well. People who want to be very active in a discussion sit in the first position when the corner turns. In other words, the chairman is on the short side, and as the corner turns to make the long side, you sit on actually the right side of the chairman. This is the most powerful seat of all the seats. Whoever sits there, if they have the mentality of it, dominate the meeting. The second position is on the left side corner. But that is less important than the right side corner. The left side corner is directly facing the right side corner. So if your number one opponent has already taken the right side corner, you sit on the left side corner. So when the right side corner person speaks, you are the perfect person to counter them directly. And then the meeting axis is between you two. Geometrically, each seat after that has a reduced potency according to where you sit, until you get to the back where it's practically nothing. And then there are those who sit on the very back facing the chairman. Interestingly, the chairman faces them, speaks to them, tries to impress them with their ability, their organizational skills, because they are the audience. Geometrically, they are the audience. If they participate, it's a very big commitment on their part because the chairman is looking at them. If they raise their hand in the back, it's a big deal for them. Not for anyone else. But it's for the chairman a big deal, because they are the competition of the chairman geometrically. Because all everybody has to do is look towards them if they were to dominate the discussion. And if that were to occur, the chairman would become in the audience position and thus reduced in power. And the people over here would be in the dominating position, especially the one who is speaking, who most likely would be sitting in the center, the direct opponent to the chairman, the competition. And the that creates the powerful position to be the person on the right corner of that one. But because the person on the right corner sat there because they wanted to disappear, there is no competition. And then that person dominates. Now, if you are a person who does not want to be in the position of dominance from the beginning in the discussion, but you are a person who will dominate because of your intellect and capacity, you sit directly in the middle on one of the sides. But you will never sit on the right side of the chairman, that long side on the right, because the dominating person also sits there. So you will not want to be in a position where you're having to compete in a weaker geometric position with the dominating speaker. So you will sit in the middle on the left side so that you can counter the dominating person and nullify the influence of the chairman and dominate the discussion when you wish and need to do so. So people who are intelligent about meetings get there early, choose their seat before someone else does. So that means this meeting is to a large extent decided by geometry, by the way in which on the battlefield of the meeting, everyone is physically situated. Think about battles. You've read in the Vedic literatures about battlefield formations. Mahabharata is filled with this stuff. In the beginning of the battle, when it's dark, before the light comes up, the armies array themselves in a particular formation. They do it at night so that the other side doesn't know what their formation is, because when you're dealing with hundreds of thousands and millions of men, you cannot change your formation on the spot. Whatever the formation is, you're stuck with it. It is what it is, and you're stuck with it. Whatever that formation you've decided on is the one you're going to have to stick with the whole day. So your first and most important responsibility as a general is to make sure that your battlefield formation is going to be the absolute best one, considering what you project to be the formation and capacity of your enemy. So a major part of the battle is fought just coming up with that strategy of geophysical formation of troops. That's pretty fantastic if you think about it. How such an important thing is decided late at night before even a battle would take place. The strategy of how to form the offensive or the defensive. Football coaches in American football do that all the time. Basketball coaches, European football coaches, everybody does the same thing. They figure out those formations. If you are aware of this, you can use it to your advantage. If you are not aware of this, you are victimized by it. So many meetings are decided by formation. Now, let's talk a little bit about this. Often, I mean, in my opinion, quite often, a lot of meetings have no point. A lot of times you have a legal structure which says you must meet every so often. There is a periodic meeting schedule. And even though you have experience from the last meeting that whatever you decided didn't really matter anyway. That people over a short period of time disregarded whatever was done. Because let's consider this. Unless you have a police department and an army, you can't enforce anything in your meeting. Unless you actually physically control something, or you economically control something, the results of your meeting are as worthwhile as much as your capacity to control that people do what you decide. If you do not have that capacity, whatever you decide has no real value, because people will do it or not do it according to how they think. If they don't like what you decided, they won't listen. If they like what you decided, they'll listen. So you know this when you enter the meeting. You have experience of spending in the previous meeting days and days of discussing, with all of the arguing back and forth about issues which seem to have been so important when you were discussing them. But you saw how none of it meant anything after a few months. Or it only meant something because people liked the decision. After all, if you get together and have a meeting and do something good for somebody, support them in what they want to do, give them facility, give them money, they like it, they cooperate. If you restrict someone in a meeting, take away their money, take away their facility, make them trouble in some way, they don't like it. They don't do it unless there's some reason for them to. And mainly, nobody cares. No one even knows what you decided, because only you know what you decided in your minute book. Or even if you publish it, who reads it? So most people couldn't care less. They just think of you as some meeting group over there that wastes time and screws things up. They don't care. Governments pass thousands of laws with huge conflicts and problems. Generally, nobody cares. Your life, the way you live it, your facilities, are not affected by any of this. And when you are affected, then you care. Then there's a transformation or a change because you are affected. That's rare. Out of the maybe 100,000 laws that are passed, maybe one or two of them might have even some slight effect on you. How can you take that seriously? Anyway, that's another issue. Personally, I'm very apolitical for various reasons, but that's one of them. Irrelevant to me. But anyway, so you know when you go into a meeting from your experience how irrelevant the meeting is, because you have that experience. So you go into a meeting, there's all this agenda. In the first beginning of the meeting, you don't really care. You're just sitting there thinking to yourself, when will this meeting be over? But then an issue comes up. And at one point, the dominating person says something. The dominating competitor counters it. It becomes an inflammation, an inflammatory issue. No one really acknowledges that instantly, but they're sitting there not feeling good because it somehow feels like something which is an attack, either on what they think is right, what they think works, on them personally, or even they're thinking, Who is this person to say like that? Who is that person to say like that? And even though they didn't care in the beginning about this issue, they didn't care about the meeting, they felt it was a waste of their time and energy, because someone said something. And anyway, they have an opinion about these people. I don't like that guy. This one's stupid. This one is envious. This one is an exploiter. Or I like that person, or whatever. So when someone says something that resonates with their feeling about them anyway, about an issue which I could cook up some emotion about, some passion about, an argument takes place. You might call it a debate about the issues, but a large amount of the time, it's a competition. The meeting becomes a competition between people who are forced to sit in the room and discuss. People who didn't care about the meeting, didn't really care about the issues. Maybe some of them cared about some of the issues or one of the issues. People who knew that whatever they decide, it doesn't mean much. Most of them, or some of them, who think that whatever you decide, I'm going to do whatever I want to do anyway. I just won't say it. A meeting turns into a competition of individuals and personalities for all the wrong reasons. There's no justifiably important reason that this should take place. And yet it does. Time after time. Parliamentary procedure was created to restrict that phenomena. But it is so cumbersome and so impossible to accomplish anything with. So then one creates groups and subgroups and committees and subcommittees. And in these subcommittees, the real work is done. Oh, anyway, that's another subject. The point I was saying is that this competition in a meeting occurs for no other reason than people are forced to sit in a meeting and talk to each other. That's why Queen Kunti said, all problems come from the interaction of people. All problems are simply created by the interaction of people. And what causes that? Our low self-esteem, our feelings that we are not good enough, and our subsequent defense to prove that we are better and superior to others. Or, if someone else is obviously better and superior to us, we are envious of that and want to cut them down so that they reduce, so that we can be superior to them. You may say, but that's a very materialistic thing. I say everybody does it, regardless of whether you're a spiritualist, you're the Pope, you're a guru, you're just someone in the background, you're anyone anywhere, in anything. This is the dynamic of the human existence. It is the very reason that everything happens, this competition. I mean, you can even have economists saying that men really wouldn't do anything if there weren't women who were pushing them to have property, to have wealth, and to have power to protect it. Otherwise, men would just lay under a tree with a bottle of booze. It's the women who are pushing the men to do these things. This is traditional economic understanding, the impetus of action. I would say that's also true, But when all the men were laying under the tree with a bottle of booze in their hands, they would fight. Because these other principles are deeper. The principle of that feeling of self, that opinion of self, and to try to maintain the integrity of self by proving oneself to be worthy, by showing that you're better than someone else. So when Lord Chaitanya said to be humbler than the grass in the street and more tolerant than a tree, he meant there's no need for competition. Everybody can be what they are. Allow them to be so. You are not going to be any better or any more worthy if you try to prove yourself to be better than anyone else. First of all, you're wasting your time because nobody will accept the proof that you're better. Even if you prove it to yourself, why should anyone else? I mean, after all, everybody feels that they are a unique spiritual entity. It's our basic feeling as human beings. Friendship that we have has nothing to do with this kind of proving and competition. What's important to us has nothing to do with this kind of proving, Jazz. So a truly spiritual person who's aware of what they are doesn't waste time entering into a conflict with anyone with the idea of proving something. And although most people would say, I'm not doing that, the only reason they say that is because they're not aware of what they're doing. And therefore, I am speaking this so that we would be aware of these issues and we will see them when they're occurring and we will deal with it appropriately and we will respond not in a competitive fashion but in a fashion which accommodates, which facilitates, which embraces, which reaches out energetically to others with empathy, regardless of how they challenge you. That Christian principle of turn the other cheek is very interesting. That Christian principle of do unto others as you would have them do unto you, very interesting. These principles of just don't get involved in competition. Don't get involved in the negative aspects of it. Don't get involved in attacking. Don't get involved in trying to do things in such a way that you waste your time worrying about other people. Just accept that we're going to have these situations only if we cooperate or we participate in them. When we don't participate in, they can't happen. It takes two to tango. If you don't participate in this, it won't continue. But you have to be more tolerant than the tree because other people are not as aware as you and they will cause you difficulty. So what do you do about it? Okay, you should try to avoid it as best you can, but not from the attitude of competition. That's a whole nother discussion about defense. I don't want to get into it now. But this very basic principle that we discussed today about competition and all the ramifications of it is directly connected to how we pursue our spirituality, how we express our spiritual integrity, how we maintain our essence in connection with the world, how we deal with this struggle. It's an art. It's not a science. It's not a formula. Do this and all works. It's an art. How you're going to deal with the moment. How you're going to deal with others. How you're going to respond. What will be your choice? What will you do? Isn't that the essence of everything? What is your next act? As essence, I live in the present, fully aware, fully connected with my consciousness and energies interacting, and everything, and I mean everything, boils down to the next act I do. What I choose to do or not do in the next moment. How I shall choose to express the integrity of being, my essence, the next moment. I am fully aware at the present. I am receiving information. I am feeling, and I am choosing how I shall respond in the next moment, and planning. So this awareness of competition, of how conflict comes and why it comes, and the very basic fundamental being of what we are, must be there for us to make appropriate, meaningful choices. First question. Oh, we got tons of questions. Oh, my God. Okay, first question. The analysis of the geometry of a meeting was very interesting. But it seems to me that it doesn't work when friends get together to meet to discuss something important like business or something. And the reason for this is that the difficulties are related to ego, but amongst friends, ego is not the predominating energy of communication. And yes, my answer is definitely I agree with that. I definitely agree with that because I feel that friendship is something very different from this situation. Friendship is something which transcends the energy of conflict. So yes, it's so. Amongst friends, you don't really have that problem because in normal meetings, what's happening is that you need to have some reason for having the meeting. And because you're not friends, what happens is that you need to have some justification of what you're doing there. So you argue like this. You compete like this. But amongst friends, you have another reason for being together. You're together because you're friends. So therefore, you don't need to have this creation of interaction because you already have an interaction that transcends that. So that's why it does not happen in a group of friends, because there's just really no reason for it to happen. So that's correct what you have written. Okay, here's another question. Recently I had an experience that was totally unexpected, and it affected me very seriously. I suppose it was related to something in my subconscious that manifested specifically because it was challenged at that moment. So the questioner is saying it was very surprising. But even more surprising, the questioner says, that one can experience a lot of love and affection when challenged like that, and that these issues can be solved by that love and affection. that these issues can be solved by that love and affection. Yes, I have spoken about this, and it's actually part of life, that these problems do not arise on their own. They require another party, a social interaction, to spark a reaction in us, which is rooted in our subconscious or even unconscious feelings of insufficiency, feelings that we are not worthy, that we are not good enough. So if somebody were to echo that, or at least we think they echo that, that's all that counts. Another person may not at all be echoing that. All that counts is that we think they are. And if we think they are echoing it, whether it's true or not, it seems to us to be a direct attack on us. A direct attack that is saying, you're not good enough. And because the whole impetus for reaction comes when we're trying to protect our integrity, to prove that we are good enough, so it creates very deep, resonating emotions, because we are seriously impacted by that feeling that was resonating within us. At that point, how the other person responds to us is extremely important. In other words, if you see that somebody is reacting in a manner which is not related to how you have communicated with them, it's your responsibility to understand why that is so, and to not reciprocate with their feelings of insufficiency, but to try to somehow support them. I have seen, and it's a problem in I think everybody's life, of course, that when someone is speaking to me in a reaction to something I might have said or written, and they are extremely defending themselves, some people defend themselves by attacking. They defend themselves by attacking other people. They, you know, it's stated the best offense, or the best defense is a good offense. In other words, if you really want to defend yourself best, create an offense, attack the other party. So we have to be aware of this and not take the attack personally, even if it's true, or even if there's something about it which may have some resonance with us. For me, this is very difficult because I'm very fast. And if somebody says something to me which is harsh or I think unjust or something, my first reaction after thinking about it for a second is to immediately reply with all kinds of reasons why it's wrong and so on. But I've learned over the years, and I'm still learning every moment, believe me, to just wait, breathe a little, go for a little walk, consider, and then adjust my response according to what is best for the person, not what is best for me. In other words, it's not in my best interest to create an argument about a misunderstanding. Sometimes I just accept, there is a misunderstanding here. You have misunderstood what I said. This is what I meant. If a person is reasonable, they will attempt to understand that. They will attempt to adjust their consciousness. They will have enough faith in me to accept that what I'm saying is true. If a person is not reasonable, or perhaps not even very smart, or perhaps doesn't trust me at all, they will continue in the same pattern. So I will continue to try to correct the misunderstanding if it's something in my interest to do so. But ultimately, if they refuse to trust or to accept or to make some kind of a compromise or whatever, then I have to do what Stephen Covey says, no deal. If in our communications it just doesn't work, they don't accept, they don't accommodate us in their consciousness and make adjustments for working together, we have the right and the responsibility to say no deal. No deal means we don't continue. I do not wish to communicate, or I do not wish to work together. It's not working. Sometimes it doesn't work just because of chemicals. Sometimes it doesn't work because one or both of us are not developed enough to handle it at this time, or that we don't have the possibility emotionally or for whatever reason at this time. It's the wrong time, wrong situation. If that's so, we have the ultimate right to say no deal. But it would be a mistake to conclude like that rapidly. These interactions we have to discuss with each other, to work with each other, to communicate with each other, even when it's difficult, is part of the discipline, is part of the growth, it's part of the evolution, where we're practically feeling there's only one of us, where we are sacrificing our position of superiority. We're sacrificing our defense mechanisms, sacrificing our ego, and allowing another person to be what they are, even in an interaction with me. That's a spiritual discipline. It's something which makes incredible muscles, spiritual muscles, that gives you power, because you are no longer controlled by fear, no longer controlled by your fear that you're not good enough and someone else will see it. No longer controlled by your fear that someone else will be superior. So, this is a spiritual discipline. And when you deal with others with that form of empathy, you are giving them a very powerful feedback. A very powerful feedback, because you are not reciprocating with, you are not encouraging, you're not justifying their fears. You are deflecting their fears and responding with support. This is what love is. To not respond to others' fears, but to always respond with love to love. It's a discipline. It is work. It is difficult. And it is wonderful. because it is the solution to most of the problems that occur between people, between religions, between groups, between everything. I hope that question was responded to. And I think I answered this other question. Well, no, this question is a good one too. Is there a way to have a communication without competition? That's a very interesting thing. How to have a communication without competition? Well, like I said, it takes two to tango. You can't say there's competition because of the other person. You can't say that the reason this communication, the reason this interaction stinks is because of that other person. They are like this. They have done that. They don't appreciate me. They don't accept me. And so on. You can't say that. It takes two to make a competition. You can't compete alone. It's impossible. Compete alone, it's a oxymoron, means nothing. Competition means to compete together. You have to compete with someone else. You can't even compete with yourself. That's a form of insanity. So competing requires there's competitors. So if you are in a communication that's a competition, that means you're a competitor. Look in the mirror. Why am I a competitor? What is it that this other party is saying or doing that turns me into a competitor? How have I become a competitor? How have I become a competitor? I'm not a competitor. I don't want to compete. Now I'm a competitor. How did that happen? Who did that to me? Well, look in the mirror. You did it to yourself. Somebody took off their gloves and threw them down on the floor. Pwah! And we took out our sword. On God! This is what we've done. We accepted what we thought was a challenge. But was it really a challenge? We'll never know because we assumed it to be. We assumed they were doing like this. We assumed it because we wanted to. We accepted it as a competition. And we reciprocated in that way as a competitor. And if you just simply refuse to be a competitor, there's no competition. If you allow someone to be what they are, there's no competition. It doesn't mean you have to do anything that someone tells you to, but you don't have to be a competitor. Now, someone else may say that no deal. Well, that's our right to say, but are we saying it for the right reasons and at the right time? Have we actually endeavored to correct the situation? Let's say I'm saying something to somebody else, and that person says, whoa, hold on, I cannot accept that. What do you do? What I do is I ask why. I ask why. I want to know why. Why is this thing unacceptable to you? So I want to discuss it. I want to discuss why it's unacceptable. I want to discuss it, number one, because I want to understand. Maybe I'm saying something wrong. I say a lot of things. I know me personally. I say sometimes things which are very impact other people very deeply. And when they tell me this is totally unacceptable, my immediate inclination is to ask why, because I'm also a bit of a detective, a researcher. I want to know why. What's going on there? What's the point? What have I done that's so wrong? I want to know why. It's out of respect. You have said something to me, and out of respect to you, I want to understand it. I should not reply by saying, "You idiot, unacceptable. You take whatever I give you." That's not very valuable. In fact, sometimes when people say it's unacceptable, and you ask why, it leads to something incredibly significant. It leads to a fantastic resolution of many problems. Sometimes within yourself, sometimes within someone else, and sometimes in the dynamic that two people share. So I see conflict often as a challenge for growth. It's not like I'm looking for conflict. I'm a kind of person who tries to avoid conflict all the time. I'm always like maneuvering myself around conflict. It's just my nature. I try to keep everybody happy. But sometimes that makes things worse. Sometimes by avoiding conflict, I increase it. And it always comes back to bite me. That's not where it bites me, but I don't have that other part on the camera. So sometimes this feeling of stress, we have to ask why. Why is it happening? What is the reason it's happening? What is the point that it's happening? It will help us expand. Okay, this is not a question and I don't feel like reading it out loud, but it's a very nice... Okay. All right, gang. I think there's no more questions. I thank you very much for being with us here today. We had a record number of listeners. And I hope that everybody found it useful. I'll see you again next week. And I wish you all love. I wish you all happiness. I wish you all peace and prosperity. I wish you all the absolute best lives. And I repeat again this wonderful mantra. All of life comes to me with ease and joy and glory. And all these communications shall come with ease and joy and glory. Because I shall not fight.